We are beginning a series entitled In the Land of Nod, and we're looking at the Reformed understanding of the two kingdoms. Before we begin the lecture, I thought I would read a brief section from a letter entitled To Diognetus, a letter written by a disciple to Diognetus. This epistle dates from about AD 130. Some scholars date it a bit later, but you can see from this epistle that the questions we're going to be talking about in this series were raised very early on in the history of the church. This is from section 5 of the letter to Diognetus. For the distinction between Christians and other men is neither in country, nor language, nor customs. For they do not dwell in cities in some place of their own, nor do they use any strange variety of dialect, nor practice an extraordinary kind of life. This teaching of theirs has not been discovered by the intellect or thought of busy men, nor are they advocates of any human doctrine as some men are. While yet living in Greek and barbarian cities, according as each obtained his lot, and following the local customs both in clothing and food and in the rest of life, they show forth the citizenship so wonderfully confessed and that strange character their constitution of their own citizenship. They dwell in their own fatherlands as if sojourners in them. They share all things as citizens and suffer all things as strangers. Every foreign country is their fatherland, and every fatherland is a foreign country. They marry as all men. They bear children, but they do not expose their offspring. They offer free hospitality but guard their purity. Their lot is cast in the flesh, but they do not live after the flesh. They pass their time on earth, but they have their citizenship in heaven. They obey the appointed laws. They surpass the laws in their own lives. They love all men and are persecuted by all men. They are unknown and they are condemned. They're put to death and they gain life. They are poor and make many rich. And the citation here is 2 Corinthians 6, verse 10. They lack all things and have all things in abundance. They are dishonored and glorified in their dishonor. They are spoken of as evil and are justified. They are abused and give blessing. They are insulted and render honor. When they do good, as they are buffeted by evildoers, when they are buffeted, they rejoice as men and receive life. They are warred upon by Jews as foreigners and persecuted by Greeks, and those who hate them cannot state the cause of their enmity. So you can see very early on that Christians were struggling with this question of how do we as Christians relate to the culture around us. Now, Aristotle, I think, nailed it when he said that man is a political animal. As a Reformed pastor, I just have lost track of the time that I have witnessed thoughtful Christians express a complete lack of interest in doctrine. And when you engage them in some doctrinal topic, you can watch their body language, and every element of it cries out, not interested. And yet, when the topic switches to politics, even the subtle nuances and fine point, they immediately light up and can recount in great detail the conversation they heard on radio the previous day or what they've seen on cable news in the past 24 hours. You would be amazed at how interested people are in politics and how disinterested they are in Christian theology. I think Aristotle nailed it, and that's one of the issues we're going to have to tackle as we go through the discussion of the two kingdoms. We have to put theology before politics. And that's going to be a struggle for some of us to put theology before politics. Now, whenever you talk about the Reformed understanding of the two kingdoms, the one thing that comes up is, why is this topic so important and why is it so controversial? Well, important, I think we all agree. Yeah, it's important. Disagreement about some of the details, certainly. But it shouldn't be controversial. The Reformed confessions all speak of distinct responsibilities given both to the church and the civil magistrate. And that implies a distinction between the power of the keys and the power of the sword. For example, the Belgic Confession has an article devoted to the authority of the church. In what areas can the church bind the conscience? That's Article 32 of the Belgic Confession. And yet there's another article devoted to the authority of the civil magistrate. What can Caesar require of citizens? Likewise, the Westminster Confession of Faith has a full chapter on the civil magistrate and several chapters on the authority of the church, chapters 25, 30, and 31. So in the Reformed Confessions, there's no explicit two kingdoms doctrine, granted. But it's certainly implied by the fact that there are different kinds of authority. There's a churchly authority, and there's a temporal authority, and that's seen given the chapters dealing with different kinds and sources of authority. Now, as David Van Drunen has demonstrated in his excellent book, Natural Law and the Two Kingdoms, the Reformed approach to the two kingdoms is longstanding and widely held within the Presbyterian Reformed churches. Now, in the contemporary American situation, largely in the Dutch Reformed churches who have embraced Abraham Kuyper's view on Christianity and culture, you'll find Christians acting as though the two kingdoms discussion is foreign, novel, and recent. And I suggest that those who feel that way need to back up and look at the larger history of the tradition and start, for example, by reading the final book in Calvin's Institutes, the final section, where Calvin basically lays out a distinction between the two kingdoms. So we'll talk about Abraham Kuyper and whether or not Kuyper is actually opposed to the two kingdoms position or not. Van Drunen makes a very compelling argument that he's actually not opposed to two kingdoms, but he has kind of a interestingly nuanced version of it, and therefore Kuyper would stand in contrast to a group we call Neo-Kuyperians, the new Kuyperians, and we'll talk about that as we go along. But the basic principle that is established in the Reformed Confessions is very simple, and we need to grasp it and hang on to it. And that principle is this: the church is never given the sword, and Caesar is never given the keys to Christ's kingdom. That is the fundamental principle laid out by the Reformed Confessions. The church is never given the sword, and Caesar's never given the keys to Christ's kingdom. But the question as to how the church seeks to fulfill its divine mandate, the Great Commission, under that divine authority, and the related questions associated with how the individual Christian citizen, under the authority of the civil magistrate, seeks to fulfill the cultural mandate, those things have become real points of contention. Now, the application then we're going to be discussing in light of this basic principle is this: the church as an organism must speak to contemporary moral issues using the categories of law and gospel. While the Christian citizen must face the challenge of living as a Christian in a largely pagan culture. So that's the way we're going to work out the application. The church has to address moral issues using the lens of law and gospel, while the citizen is forced to work out that faith in a largely pagan culture. Now, my own narrow focus in this series of lectures in the Land of Nod is this. I'm going to be addressing the intersection of Christianity and culture in a very general sense, and the funnel will get narrower as we go along. But my real focus in these lectures is a Christian's political responsibilities within the civil kingdom. What does it mean to be a Christian and an American? So we'll not be addressing the arts or the sciences or broad cultural themes, but primarily those responsibilities that we as Christians have within the civil kingdom. What does it mean to be a Christian and an American? And since we're going to be talking about the Reformed conception of the two kingdoms, I'm further going to limit our discussion to a presentation, then a positive presentation of the Reformed doctrine of the two kingdoms, with some interaction with competing views within the Reformed tradition. I'm thinking especially of transformationalism and theonomy, and therefore I don't want to talk about broader things like the Roman Catholic view of church and culture in various eras. I don't want to get into radical orthodoxy and other things that are really beyond my skill set anyway. I'm going to concentrate on the Reformed understanding of the two kingdoms, so I want to be very clear to anybody here or anybody listening that this is a very narrowly focused approach. So when somebody complains, well, you didn't cover that, you're probably right, and there's a good reason why I didn't. That wasn't my intention. Now, I suggest, and I'm going to raise this case throughout this series of lectures, that our current political and cultural situation explains much of the heat and the lack of light in contemporary discussions of the Reformed understanding of the two kingdoms. So I think it's important that we do a bit of intellectual history here to understand why things are so heated whenever you raise the topic of the two kingdoms within various Reformed circles. Now, let's go back in American history to the colonial and post-colonial period, because as long as Christians conceived of America as a Christian nation, and there are two ways you could conceive of America as a Christian nation. One is the erroneous view that America has some sort of a covenant with God. You find this in popular Christian writings of David Barton. You find this in the best-selling work of a generation ago by Peter Marshall, the idea that God has some sort of a covenant relationship with America. If that's your view, that's going to color how you understand the Christian's relationship to culture. The other way we could describe America as a Christian nation is in a purely descriptive sense. We can say that America is a Christian as opposed to a Jewish or an Islamic or a secular nation, at least historically. We can use the phrase Christian nation as an adjective that describes how America is in its broad outlook and its broad perspective on things. And as long as you conceive of America as a Christian nation, either of those two senses, then American Christians are going to feel very comfortable in the public square. Moral causes make sense. Moral causes resonate throughout the culture. Just go back and look at the history, the abolitionist movement, or prohibition, or other issues. In many cases, the pulpit was part of the public square. But the level of comfort in the public square felt by Christians began to fade, and the public square seems increasingly hostile and, dare I say, foreign to Christians now. And there are a number of reasons for this, and we have to have these reasons before our eyes to understand why we're in a different situation than our forebears were. The first thing that has changed the climate and atmosphere of the public square is the Scopes trial. After the Scopes trial, Christianity is now perceived as hostile to modern science. Before Scopes, the public had the general sense that science was thinking God's thoughts after him. After the Scopes trial, anybody who believes the Bible is simply denying science. And you have to deny science to believe the Bible. And so the byproduct of this hostility is that faith then is seen by American culture as subjective and irrational, and therefore a private matter. Faith is detached from science, it's detached from investigation, therefore it's a private matter. Reason, on the other hand, in American culture is seen as objective and rational, and therefore reason is the basis for public discourse. So Christians, in the contemporary mindset, cannot bring matters of faith, private religious convictions, into the public square. Faith is subjective. It's your private religious opinion. What business do you have bringing that into the public square where we're talking about civic responsibilities? A second reason why the public square is increasingly hostile and foreign to Christians is the rise of the sovereign self. And this could merit an entire academy series in its own right. If you trace a trajectory in American intellectual history from Emerson down to Thoreau, and then down to someone like William James, who was the first American philosopher who was actually read by European philosophers, you get this sense that the self becomes sovereign, that I am the final arbiter of all things. No other culture other than North America, and the United States in particular, could you find a person like Walt Whitman writing a song to myself. That's just so uniquely American that everything centers around me. And of course, William James, in his famous book on pragmatism, argued that the truth of any religion is tied to its cash value in terms of experience. So James stands at that tail end of that transcendentalist romantic notion that pops up in New England. And of course, who had been in New England before the transcendentalists? The New England Puritans. There's some intellectual ties there with the debate on the freedom of the will and where you locate the will in terms of the other mind and so on. Long story, we could do a whole course on that. But what happens is, again, the focus shifts from the objective, discussions of truth and, say, the importance of doctrine, to the subjective. Now it doesn't matter what you believe and the propositions that you're affirming is true. Now what matters is, how do you feel? And you can see this every night on the news, when immediately after the news headline is reported, reporters in the field walk up to people with an open mic and ask them, how do you feel about this? I'm sure that's a nice person. I'm sure they mean well. I don't care how they feel about this event. It's the job of the news to tell me what happened and let me figure out what I want to do with that information. That's one place where this becomes an issue. Ironically, evangelicals accidentally illustrate the widespread influence of the sovereign self upon American religion when we stress a born-again experience over faith as trust in something objective, namely the finished work of Christ. What is the common tie among evangelicals? Do they all believe and affirm the same doctrinal statement? No. If you go on the websites of most contemporary American churches, you can't find a doctrinal statement. What ties that amorphous blob of churches we call evangelicals together? A common experience. Can you give evidence that you have had a born-again experience? Now, I'm not at all saying that regeneration is not part of the Ordo Salutis. Christians absolutely must be born again in order to exercise faith. But is the primary evidence that I'm a believer, that I have had this subjective Christ's experience, or that I trust the finished work of Christ? Well, biblically, it's profession of faith in the finished work of Christ. And you see this, for example, when someone grows up in the church and may never, ever have had a conversion experience, but can tell you that they're born again. I jokingly said to many of you, I used to feel guilty growing up in church because I didn't have a very good testimony. Why? Because I've always believed the gospel. I can't ever recall a time when I didn't trust Christ. So I didn't have a conversion experience, but I can give evidence, I think, that I've always been converted. So when this happens, Christianity becomes a religion of the heart, hence the dichotomy between head knowledge and heart knowledge. You've heard this many times. And so what happens is Christianity becomes thoroughly Americanized. And I dare say that much of what passes for Christianity in America, especially under the label evangelical, is more American than Christian. And it comes out of this laboratory of Emerson, Thoreau, and William James. And that's a grossly simplistic intellectual line, but I think for this lecture it makes the point. Third thing we're up against, why we feel such hostility in the public square, is the decline of the Protestant establishment. The public square is now much less amenable to the old Protestant consensus that many still assume to be the norm. I'm going to argue this case, but I don't think we can approach the public square as though it's still Protestant and Christian. I think that's foolish to view the public square in that way. And I think we see this in the decline of distinctly Christian universities. Look at all the Ivy League schools with their original charters to be places to train ministers. I mean, you just, whoever planted the University of California at Irvine never once thought for a million years that any kind of a religious person would ever graduate from the place. That implied in the intention of founding the university is kind of snuffing out stuff like that. Christian hospitals. Right down the street was a hospital called Martin Luther Hospital. And I had a person comment to me, a person who shall go nameless, who said, isn't it great they named a hospital after a political leader? And then that hospital was purchased by a large hospital chain and became Humana. And just think of the name change, Martin Luther Humana. Just that, the titles tell you a great deal about how things have changed over the course of time. Cultural institutions. What Christian cultural institutions are there? TBN? I don't think so. So, We can also see this decline of the Protestant establishment in something as simple as the religious representation of the United States Congress. Go back and look at Congress in 1920 and look at the churches the members of Congress attended. Presbyterian, Methodist, Episcopal. With the decline of mainline Protestantism because of Protestant liberalism, what two religions have jumped greatly in terms of congressional identity? Roman Catholicism and Judaism. Now, you could fairly say that that's not a bad thing because Jews and Roman Catholics have the classical categories of Western civilization and understand the importance of the Decalogue. That's probably a good thing. It's not a bad thing that Jews and Catholics have a greater representation in the Congress. But it does show, I think, very clearly the decline in the Protestant establishment. And for its history, America has been largely Protestant. Some of you are too young to remember the election of JFK. It's one of the first things I remember. But the big issue with John Kennedy was he was a Roman Catholic. And the fear was, and Kennedy had to give a news conference devoted to this to explain that he was not a minion of the papacy. So we've moved a long way from the nervousness about Kennedy being elected president to Catholics regaining a lot of the ground, or claiming a lot of the ground that mainline Protestants used to hold in the United States. So that's number three. Number four, the Playboy philosophy and birth control. I link them together, you could divide them, but Hugh Hefner's Playboy philosophy basically gutted traditional biblical morality when it came to sexual relations as only proper between a husband and a wife. And Hefner charted an entire philosophy of basically circumventing the marriage institution strictly for the idea of pursuing sexual pleasure. Add to that birth control, and now there are far fewer worries about pregnancy, and you have a society now adopting an entirely secularized sexual ethic at virtually every level, to the point that American sexual ethics are now thoroughly libertine and increasingly pagan. There is a strong connection between sexual libertine views and paganism historically, and to justify the libertine behavior, you're going to have to look to pagan antecedents. You're going to have to find them in the East, in Greece, and in Rome, because you can't find them in the Christian tradition in the West. So this becomes a huge issue. This undermines at virtually every level the traditional view of marriage and the family. And this has had a tremendous effect upon the public square. Fifth, Roe versus Wade. The right to abort a human fetus was read into the Constitution under a very specious principle of a right to privacy. And emboldened by Roe versus Wade and its successive withstanding the scrutiny of the courts, the higher courts of the land now increasingly seek to move society in a more progressive direction from the bench, oftentimes against the will of the electorate. One thing new to the public square, and perhaps the predominant view in the public square now, is judicial activism. That the courts trump the legislatures, and the courts trump the electorate. I've lost track because several states recently have approved gay marriage by popular vote. But up until the Supreme Court decision, it was, 38-0? Electorates voting down gay marriage? I mean, it had never passed anywhere until the court made its recent decision. So this idea of judicial activism becomes a real dampening force upon Christians who are in the public square. We're afraid now the courts are our enemies and our rights are going to be taken away and our freedom's going to be greatly restricted. Now, that single event, Roe versus Wade, motivated countless American evangelicals to redress the situation through political action and political activism. I'm sure you all remember Operation Rescue. And some of us actually participated in the human chains. Remember that?
to go around blocks to show people we were pro-life. This is admittedly the turning point for Francis Schaeffer. It's How Then Shall We Live, greatly motivated by the Roe versus Wade decision, is what led Schaeffer to publish a Christian manifesto in response, as he said, to the Communist Manifesto. This encouraged evangelicals to go into the public square and become politically active in ways in which they had not been prior to Roe versus Wade. And somebody, I hope in our tradition, goes back and looks at Schaeffer's development of his thought on this, because there's some ways in which I don't think Schaeffer would be comfortable with what's been done with his stress on political activism. Schaeffer approached this, as I understand Schaeffer, largely in terms of intellectual history, like we're doing here, but activists seized on this and used Schaeffer's work as the benchmark to engage in political activism. And I'm not sure Schaeffer would be entirely comfortable with that, but I'm not a Schaeffer expert and may be wrong about that, but I'd like to see some work done in that area. Another thing we have to say, as we talk about the effects of Roe versus Wade on the public square, is legalized abortion is now considered an established right under the law. It just is. And mind you, this is under a series of what we would have to identify as conservative presidencies and a conservative court. So for those who think if we just get the right people in the right offices, everything's going to change, I suggest that's a very naive understanding of how things like this are moving. I just don't think that's true, and I don't think that bears the weight of scrutiny. And I do think we have to say that after Roe versus Wade, Christians now see the public square in an entirely different light. Many Christians who view America as a Christian nation from Roe versus Wade on now have kind of given up the preoccupation and fascination with America as a Christian nation. This has been a real watershed in terms of how Christians felt about the amenability of the public square to Christian faith. A sixth thing we have to keep before our eyes is the corrosive effect of popular culture. We could spend hours on this alone, but think of the worship of celebrity. What have the Kardashians ever accomplished other than to make themselves rich and famous? Do they have any talent? Yes, making money. They are celebrities. They're known for being celebrities. What do they do? What talents do they have? What have they accomplished? Nothing except they're famous. And we could go on and on and on with the worship of celebrity. This is true for men with sports figures. It's true for young adults with rock stars. It's true with people who adore Hollywood celebrities. Look at the success of People Magazine, National Enquirer, TMZ, all of those things show the fascination of this culture with celebrities. And we even will find legions of people flocking after them with cameras to record their every move. I mean, the paparazzi are just legendary in this country because of our love of celebrity. You can make an entire career taking pictures of celebrities doing things they don't want you to know that they're doing and die rich and famous for doing that. Now, connected to this is, of course, the crass consumerism that goes along with the consumption economy tied to the worship of celebrity. One of the things that struck me when we first started to learn about 9/11 and who Osama bin Laden was, bin Laden making the case that, you know, Nike's everywhere in the Middle East, and our people are worshiping this Michael Jackson character. And you kind of felt like, could we talk? Because I think you might find that not all Americans think that's a good thing to export that around the world. But the rise of pop culture has done serious damage to folk culture and local culture and individual culture. It just, sanding machine, just burrs down all distinctions and creates this amorphous pop culture that transcends all cultures. And one place where you can see this in a more positive way, if you look at, say, somebody was mentioning Rick Steves the other day, the guy that runs the travelogues in Europe. Look at the recent ones. When you look at the cities in Europe, the people there are dressed exactly like Americans are dressed. You see no local folk costume. Everybody's got T-shirts, the same jeans, the same shoes. The women have the same fashions. There's just kind of this globalizing of fashion, music, culture, and so on. The number one TV show in the world is Top Gear. It's probably a good thing. Top Gear is a great show, by the way. But the fact that a BBC broadcast would be worldwide and the most popular shows this universal pop culture and how impactful. The area where it affects our discussion would be celebrity authorities. This is the only culture that I know of that'll take some Hollywood figure who's read a book once and made a movie about something and regard them as an expert in the field. And that has lowered the level of discussion in the public square exponentially. This is the blind leading the blinder. You know, this is a bad development. And yet you let an expert try and speak to the field, and he's boring, I can't follow it, it's over my head, I don't be bothered. This is a very serious situation, and it's corrosive at every level, and this has had a tremendous impact upon how Christians feel in the public square. A seventh one, and I raise this not for the political implications per se, but it's a reality. The election of Barack Obama brought a tremendous change in the attitude toward Christians in the public square. And although he is a professing Christian, and mind you, a professing Christian running against a member of a church that is a non-Christian sect, Mitt Romney, many American Christians are openly hostile to Obama because of what they perceive to be an increase in federal power, whether that be in environmental issues, doing things by legislative fiat, Obamacare and the mandate that came with it to religious institutions to violate their own consciences in terms of things like birth control and abortion services, and then the concern about the abuse of executive power through the legislative initiatives, the mandates that come out of the White House that circumvent the Congress. Now, for those who are concerned about Obama doing that, it seems to me 43 was pretty good at doing some of this as well. This is one of the real crises facing contemporary Americans, and that is the Congress going to do its job? And since the Congress is not doing its job and legislating and doing the providing the oversight it is supposed to, the presidency continues to take advantage of that situation, and our last few presidents have abused their power. That has created a situation in which American Christians are increasingly nervous about that kind of abuse and feel far less at home in the public square than they did prior to that. And eight, and this one's self-evident, this is the Supreme Court's recent decision on gay marriage. I think most American Christians feel as though the public square is now actively hostile to Christianity. No longer indifferent, no longer slighting, Roe versus Wade turned the corner, this is the banana peel that the culture stepped on and slipped and fallen and isn't going to get up. This is the turning point away from all things Christian. And I think most Christians perceive it to be such. Now, all that is to say, this very dramatic and rapid change in the public square toward Christianity and what's commonly described as a Judeo-Christian foundation of the law, from I think what you could say is the amenable 1870s, where the pulpit was part of the public square, to the indifferent 1900s, where Christians could speak to issues in the public square, pastors did regularly, but people were somewhat indifferent to that, to the hostile 2000s, that change from kind of an amenability to an indifference and an apathy to overtly hostile has provoked fear on the part of Christians. It's provoked anger on the part of Christians, and it creates a sense that we all feel somebody do something. Now, some Christians have done something. They've embraced the change. The statistics in the last several elections show that more politically liberal and social conservative evangelicals have endorsed some of these changes. The polls pick out evangelical Christians that 10 years earlier would never have voted for a progressive Democrat, now do so. And some in the who watch these things see that's a sign of a deterioration of the public square. Whether it is or not, you can be the judge of that. But that fact alone creates kind of a bit of angst. Some, and a significant sum here, have vowed to fight the change. These are the folks who identify as culture warriors. They have made it their business to loudly and as passionately as they can oppose the things we've just been talking about, and to do so in a very public way, and these are often identified as culture warriors. Third, there are some who've just dropped out of the political process altogether. They see this, they see the trends, their response is to not show up at the polls because if I vote, nothing happens anyway. And you can see the numbers in the last several elections, the percentage of registered voters who actually show up on election day is dropping. Fewer and fewer people register to vote. And then you have kind of a political move, say with libertarians, who call down fire on both sides and move to a third party that doesn't have the polarized spat that the Democrats and the Republicans have. So you see a lot of people just dropping out of the political process. Meanwhile, the Reform have decided to fight with each other over what to do and their understanding of these developments. So understandably then, in a lot of these real, and they're not imagined, signs of the coarsening of American culture, Christians are alarmed. Christians are concerned. How can we not be? So the question then about the role the church should play in resisting and challenging this increasing hostility to all things Christian raises a number of important questions that require answers in light of our uniquely American religious environment and history, and in light of the new challenges that we face as Christians in a post-Christian era. And I'll talk more about that in a bit. Is it part of the church's mission to address this obvious decline? And if so, how? That's one of the questions we're going to tackle as we proceed along in our series. Second question, does the church's biblical mandate include the transformation of culture? And if so, how? Third, what does this transformation mean in reality? Now, it's one thing to argue that Christians must bring every area of life under the lordship of Christ. The famous words of Abraham Kuyper, of every square inch of this earth, Christ says, mine. Well, what do we do when non-Christians turn around and say, no, it's mine? And they do. How would the lordship of Christ over every area of life look in our context? What would it look like? It's one thing to fire up the battle cry. It's another thing to say, what is this going to look like in concrete reality? And fourth question we're going to tackle, if we seek to transform culture, how do we escape the ever-present danger of becoming social gospelers? I hear lots of transformationalists say things that sound very much like Shaler Matthews and some of the other Protestant progressive theologians at the beginning of the 19th century. There's a sense in which how do we engage in a social gospel transformative gospel without that becoming the gospel? And that's a question we have to raise and we have to tackle. A fifth question. Does the Reformed approach to the two kingdoms require us to check our Christian faith at the door of the civil kingdom? If we're going to argue for two kingdoms, are we saying that because the civil kingdom has a different kind of authority under the lordship of Christ than the kingdom of Christ does that mean that when I walk in the voting booth, I check my faith at the entrance to the polls? And we're going to tackle that question, argue that in the negative. Sixth, what do we say to those? And this discussion, by the way, has just gone on again in great length. What do we say to those who would have used the two-kingdom distinction, or who have used the two-kingdom distinction, to dodge the pressing moral issues of the day? As when some argued for the spirituality of the church and used that as a cover to hold slaves during the Civil War. There's a long-standing group of Southern Presbyterians who are very ardent two-kingdom folk. They argue that the church is spiritual in nature, not political, not tied to the civil kingdom. Therefore, I can't judge in terms of church discipline someone who is a slaveholder, because that's a matter of the civil kingdom. And there's a lot of discussion on the Whitehurst Inn blog just this last couple weeks of the Southern Presbyterians and were they right about that. And I think the consensus that was reached by pretty much everyone, with a couple of notable exceptions, is, yeah, those Presbyterian churches should have disciplined slaveholders, and they should have raised heresy charges against them if they argued for slavery on the grounds that African Americans were of some different kind of race than Europeans. And there's a famous Presbyterian theologian who argued that because the Negro population, as he called it, had so separated themselves from the other races that they had gone on their own trajectory and had become something other than human. So there are cases where people will use the spirituality of the church and the model of the two kingdoms to dodge political responsibility. And so if we're going to hold to the two kingdoms, we have to address and respond to those kinds of challenges as well. And, you know, you talk about getting people angry, that's one that really gets the blood pressure going. So again, I hope you can all see why these questions become very heated, because they're dealing with very important political questions, but they challenge us at fundamental levels as our own prejudice and our own understanding of the mission of the church. Now, whenever you talk about this, the pink elephant in the room is the ongoing blog and bulletin board debate over the two kingdoms. And I'm very afraid you're going to find far too little light and far too much passive-aggressive bravado from men who are very brave while hiding behind the safety of their keyboards and their computer monitors. Every blogger is a theologian, right? No, they're not. And I would encourage you to be thoughtful about whose blog you're reading and their background and their training, because someone can compose an eloquent sentence and not butcher the King's English doesn't necessarily mean they're qualified to speak to the matters upon which they speak so bravely. Now, it's remarkable to me to see so many who want to see the church transform culture think nothing of breaking the Ninth Commandment by misrepresenting those with whom they disagree. My advice to you all is to read thoughtful books and primary sources on the topic and to avoid the vitriol that takes place in the blogosphere on this. I don't think there's much helpful out there. There are a couple I would recommend, but not many. And the vitriol is just off the charts. Frankly, the level of discourse that goes on in many of these blogs is just shameful. And I've read far too many descriptions of the so-called radical two-kingdom view from men who are Reformed and Presbyterian church officers. And yet, I can't find anything there but a grotesque straw man. The things that are condemned are things that ought to be condemned, but they're not things two kingdom believers hold, at least anybody I know of. There may be exceptional cases, but that's not the position. And on the other hand, I see a number of two kingdom folk act as though the self-evident cultural decline and the corresponding rise of paganism is nothing but a trifle, and therefore of no real concern to them, and so therefore it shouldn't be to the church and to its members. And whenever that situation arises, I just direct them to the parents of countless families in the Reformed church world struggling to understand what to do and who are asking their pastors almost on a daily basis, what's the church going to do to help? So, no doubt, this is a complex and difficult subject, and there are very few historical precedents to help us. And it doesn't help matters when people who are trying to discuss this are overheated and emotional, and quite frankly, worried about the future of their country. Now, if you think things are going to hell in a hurry, the answer, well, that's not the church's responsibility, just isn't going to work. At the same time, it's foolish to expect the church, which is a pilgrim embassy of Jesus Christ sojourning on the earth in Nod, to seek to claim dominion or reclaim America for Christ, and given the cautions of someone like James Davison Hunter, to rapidly change American intellectual life and culture, as well as what transpires in the public square, I suggest to you that's a fool's errand. America, to the extent that we may describe it as Christian, is now post-Christian. And like it or not, that's the reality. Now, I know this will give some folk heartburn, but I suggest that much relief will come when Christians realize and accept that the old Protestant consensus in America is gone, and that we as evangelical Christians are clearly in the minority in the public square. And so we find ourselves in a new intellectual age, and therefore we cannot operate under old intellectual assumptions. Now, by that I mean, instead of seeking to regain lost glory and to win America back, which, by the way, scares non-Christians to death, I suggest focusing upon thinking and acting like an influential minority, well known for our personal piety. Wouldn't that be a surprise if our culture thought, you know, those Christians are really pious people, instead of, they're all like Jimmy Swaggart. For our personal piety, if we were well known for our winsome and thoughtful manner of expression, if we didn't participate in the scream fest that goes on every night on Bill O'Reilly and Fox News, if we had arguments that were actually compelling and actually pinned a non-Christian shoulders to the mat, and that we be people of principle again instead of people of political expediency. That's something that we have to regain, and that's something I'm going to contend throughout these lectures that we do. I'll also suggest, following Hunter again, that the church depoliticize itself as quickly and as far as possible. Now, it's sad, it's heartbreaking, that we live in an age when non-Christians know more about a church's politics, you're gay and therefore you're a bigot, anti-gay and therefore you're a bigot, than they do about our church's theology. Do non-Christians know we're Trinitarian, that we believe Jesus is the Son of God? Far fewer know that than know our political positions. And that means the church has been very unfaithful in its witness to the gospel in this culture. And while it is important to identify the ideal so we can formulate coherent and thoughtful arguments, you know, what is a Christian perspective on ethics in this case and what would that entail, it's equally important to realize that the ideal is not likely attainable in the civil kingdom as it presently exists. You know, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but unlike the kingdom of Christ, where it is thus saith the Lord, in the civil kingdom, we have to be practical and willing to compromise. The history of politics tells us one thing, man, politics is messy and it's ugly. We can't let the ideal become the enemy of the best possible outcome. You know, the related expression, we can't let the perfect get in the way of the what we can accomplish. I think that's a very true set of circumstances. So, we live in a post-Christian culture. We always hold out the possibility that God, in his sovereign and merciful providence, may indeed reverse the course of things. But until he does, I suggest that the conversation about the church's relationship to the civil kingdom needs to shift away from the glories of the past and the unattainable ideal and the perfect case to the real world in which we actually live. And when we do that, I think the Reformed doctrine of the two kingdoms will provide us with a very helpful way forward. Now, in light of the preceding, it's apparent that we're living in a unique time and under very new and a different set of circumstances than our Reformed and Presbyterian forebears. And we ignore those differences, I think, to our peril. While we may learn much from the Christians of the first three centuries who did succeed in evangelizing much of the pagan world, we live in a time in which paganism has reclaimed most of that ground. The thoroughly secularized socialist democracies of the Western world, I think, are proof of that. You know, the world of the early church had not yet been evangelized, but it now has, and now we find it in full apostasy, sadly. Some seek a return to the glories of Christendom, as though Constantine and Charlemagne were the high water marks of Christian civilization, and therefore the model for a Christian future and the ideal for which we are to strive. And while I don't agree, let's, for the sake of argument, assume that those two epochs were high water marks in the history of the Christian church. What does medieval Christendom have to do with the modern world? Not much. And unless you're post-millennial, unless your eschatological optimism pans out hundreds of years down the road, well, Christendom's not coming back. Not in your lifetime anyway. And then there are those in the current debate who contend, in agreement with Calvin, that it's the civil magistrate's duty to enforce the first table of the law. Well, as important as Calvin is in understanding the development of Reformed political theory, when Calvin speaks of the role of the civil magistrate, Calvin could not even begin to conceive of a secularist democracy that now rules Europe. And therefore, his value in terms of his understanding of how the church ought to relate to the magistrate is limited because of the change in circumstances. And that, I think, is self-evident in the fact that all of the Reformed confessions written at the time of the Reformation have all been changed in the United States in the articles that deal with the church's relationship to the civil magistrate, because the situation here is entirely different than it was in the days of the Reformation. And the Reformed churches, both Presbyterian and Reformed, have acknowledged that. And let me play a bit of advocacy here. What if Calvin's right about the civil magistrate? And by the way, I tend to think he is. He's on the right track here. What would the magistrate enforcing the first table of the law look like in a real world of Barack Obama and the current U.S. Congress? Do we really want the magistrate in its current form to protect the church, its gospel, and its doctrine? There is a law of unintended consequences. And we have to think very, very carefully about the consequences of taking particular actions. It's one thing to argue, yeah, Calvin says we should recover the first table of the law enforced by the civil magistrate. Okay, I think there's a good biblical basis for that. I'm going to argue for it. What's that going to look like in the United States? So, we no longer live in an America with a generic Protestant political establishment in which the public square was amenable, the best case, or indifferent to Christian morality. The worst case, in many ways, the public square is now openly hostile to Christianity, and the people in the public square prefer that we not participate. And if we do, we check our faith at the door. Ironically, then, we're in the brave old world. Biblically speaking, we're in the land of Nod, east of Eden, and I'm going to argue that throughout this series of lectures. So, as we go forward, I'm going to suggest that there are three points of view we need to take when we consider some of these topics, especially as they're related to being a Christian citizen. The first is the ideal, what Christians could expect under the best of all circumstances. The second is the biblical, what does Scripture actually say about the authority of the church and the responsibilities of the Christian citizen? And third, there is the real, what can we actually expect under the current circumstances? Let me give you an example of what I mean. Now, we may conclude that in terms of the ideal, wouldn't it be great to have a Christian magistrate, a Reformed Christian magistrate, who maybe signed one of the Reformed confessions, who was in full submission to the Word of God? We'd all say that would be great, wouldn't it? And we could then say Romans 13 would define how that person would understand his office and his rule. Then there's the real. Do we want the U.S. Congress or Jerry Brown in any sense thinking that they have legislative authority over the decisions, the affairs, and the worship of the church? I don't think so. But I do expect that the Anaheim police are going to show up if protesters ever attempt to disrupt our worship services on Sunday morning because they don't like our theology. I think we can expect that of the civil magistrate, that the civil magistrate may have a practical role in protecting the church so the church can preach the first table of the law. And those are the kind of things we're going to try and wrestle through as we get farther along in this series. Now, again, reality tells us we live in a thoroughly secular state, although there's some vestiges of the Christian heritage remaining. We are, in fact, in a post-Christian era. And another related point to that reality is this. We have to face the fact that Protestant evangelicals are now a minority and therefore should act like it. And I dare say if Protestants are now in the minority and evangelicalism is shrinking in terms of its numbers and its influence, what does that make us as Reformed Christians? We're a blip. We're a tiny little blip. NAPARC has, 750,000 Reformed Christians? Mind you, the influence Reformed Christians exercise on evangelicalism is greater than our numbers. Just look at the fact that the folks who read most Christian theology texts and who publish them are, in fact, Reformed Christians. But we are a blip. And when our folks get together and talk about the role of the magistrate, the role of the church, we act like we run the Vatican. We have these grandiose expectations and assumptions about how much power we have. We have very little power in the civil kingdom. We have unlimited power in the kingdom of God. We forget that. Because all the while we're debating about the civil kingdom, the gospel is going forward, people are converted and coming to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, and churches are being planted and established. We forget that. And we think we have political power because our arguments are better than those evangelicals or Roman Catholics. We're a blip. We're a tiny little blip. And it's important to realize that and keep that in mind. So that means we need to think like a minority. And I think a helpful model that's been proposed is a loyal opposition, if you wish. We need to do those things well, which we can actually do. And that means focusing on the local, not the universal. I'm going to make the case that a lot of Christian reflection on the civil kingdom is misguided because it doesn't grow out of someone's ecclesiology and the understanding of what it is that their membership in the local church actually entails and what responsibilities that local church actually has. I'm going to suggest that is the starting point to talk about the civil kingdom, and that means local, not universal. I'm also going to contend throughout that the Reformed Two Kingdoms views of the duties of a Christian citizen is grounded in two things necessarily. One is our eschatology, which is amillennial. My postmillennial friends, sorry, but the Reformed confessions are amillennial. You got to slide your fingers behind your hand to get in. If you're postmillennial, okay, we you know, Hodge and Warfield got in, that's fine. But it's one thing to be amillennial and yet act like you're postmillennial, and to have such an expectation that the church is going to so transform culture that practically you are postmillennial in your expectation. I'm going to argue that our eschatology has to shape our view of culture. Now, I'm also one who says throw out the optimism-pessimism paradigm that Greg Bahnsen dumped on us. I don't think that paradigm works. I think it is in some ways misleading because I'm very optimistic about the kingdom of God. I'm just pessimistic about the city of man. So I'm very optimistic about what God's doing and tend to be suspicious of what sinful people do. So I've argued in an essay, you may want to read it, that throw that model out and adopt a biblical realism. There are things to be optimistic about and there are things to be realists about. And our eschatology drives that. The second thing we're going to talk about is our ecclesiology, and it is Presbyterian. Christ rules his church through three offices, minister, elder, and deacon. And those offices then represent the way in which Christ rules his church, and those officers then provide for the kind of power of the keys language that Jesus gives to the church, because at that level the church can discipline its members who commit crimes in the civil kingdom. There are ramifications of your ecclesiology. The second thing is we would want to say here, does the church have any authority in speaking to the civil kingdom in moral matters? Yeah, the church's job is to preach the law and the gospel. Is the church ever to engage in partisan politics? No. If you understand the mission of the church is tied to its marks, you're going to be very circumspect about what you want to see the church do in the public square. It grows out of your ecclesiology. And those things are necessarily connected. I'm going to try and establish that case. I think you have to think about these things before you talk about our civic responsibilities. The other thing we have to recover, because it's lost, is the old Protestant doctrine of vocation. Because it's there that the question, what do we do as American citizens, gets answered. God gives to us callings and vocations in the civil kingdom. And so the old Protestant assumption that the farmer plowing his fields was performing an act of worship is a good one and a biblical one. As Luther said, the person who makes a good shoe and sells it at a fair price is doing the right thing. Someone who's called to wealth, as Calvin said, is given this great responsibility because a wealthy person is providing for the well-being of all of those who work for them, and therefore has to be a good steward of wealth. And as Calvin says, that person's given a great responsibility to help the poor. So calling and vocation will answer a lot of the questions that critics of Two Kingdom raise when they say, well, are you saying then that the church has no responsibility in the public square? No, I'm saying the church has a prophetic role in the public square, and that the church is to teach its members to fulfill their vocations. And that's what I mean when I'm talking about the local focus. We tend to think of global strategies. How well has that worked for us? Do we think about how our church impacts our neighborhood and the families of the members of our churches? Not as much, and I think that's where our focus has to come back on that topic. So, our eschatology must define our understanding of the nature and character of life in the age between the two advents of Christ. What does Scripture actually teach about the role and mission of the church? And it's tied to both of those. What is life to be like for a Christian in the civil kingdom until the Lord returns? What does our eschatology tell us about the expectations we would have of the friendliness of Caesar toward us? Paul sees in Romans 13 the state as a minister of God. John sees the Roman state in Revelation 13 as the beast empowered by the dragon to wage war on the saints. And so we as Christians have to have submission to the governing authorities and yet be fully aware that in the providence of God, the state can become bestial and wage war upon the people of God. And I think that is going to give us a strong dose of realism in terms of how much we're going to look for ultimate solutions in the civil kingdom. Civil kingdom is important, but is it a place where we find ultimate solutions? In the civil kingdom, what kind of solutions can we find? Political solutions. But we can't find ultimate solutions in the civil kingdom. So, as we go forward then, the lectures are going to be divided into three parts, and I'm hoping to get, in this first block of lectures, to get far into the first part of the overall lectures. And that is to talk about the land of Nod. I'm obviously referring to Adam and Eve being cast out of Eden to wander in Nod, east of Eden. And the land of Nod then is a metaphor, an image here. And we'll talk about a biblical theology of dual citizenship and its implications for the citizen of Nod, the Christian citizen of Nod. Because you are both a Christian and an American citizen. You have dual citizenship and therefore dual responsibilities. The second part of the series will be called The Church in Nod, not The Church of Nod. The Church of Nod, I'm going to argue, is Christendom. This unholy marriage where the church marries the state. What kind of children will come from that marriage? What are the kind of things that are produced? They're not holy things, are they? And so we're going to talk about why we have to view the church as the pilgrim embassy from God for us in the midst of Nod. But it's not the church of Nod, it's the church in Nod. And then the third part is entitled The Citizen of Nod. Because we are citizens of the land of Nod in the civil kingdom, what are our responsibilities as Christian citizens? And so, therefore, what does it mean to be a Christian in America? And so, in conclusion, although we as Reformed Christians often disagree among ourselves about how to live in such a time as ours, Lord willing, these discussions will help us advance our understanding of these issues, and Lord willing, help us think through the implications of what it means to be a Christian and an American as we work through the Scriptures, as we look at our confessions, and as we look at the writings of our fathers in the faith, as well as through, I hope, respectful interaction with those within our tradition with whom we disagree. The goal is to move the ball forward to get us to think about these things and, Lord willing, come to some reasonable conclusions. Now, in the few minutes I have left, I want to give you the bibliography and want to call your attention to a couple of things on this because I hope I've wet your whistle for some further reading and further study. This is a very select bibliography, things that I would suggest you take a look at, and I've tried to highlight not just stuff on Two Kingdoms, but stuff on related issues that I know you are interested in because of the questions you've asked me. First of all, if you're interested in theonomy and you want to read the standard statement of defense, you go to Greg Bonson's Theonomy and Christian Ethics. That's the standard statement in defense of theonomy. Recently, D.A. Carson has published a book called Christ and Culture Revisited, and he goes back and looks at the ground that was covered in H. Richard Niebuhr's book, Christ and Culture. And Niebuhr, of course, has given us the five main categories that Christians use when talking about Christian culture. And Niebuhr, unfortunately, identifies the Reformed view as Christ the transformer of culture. And I'm going to argue that Niebuhr pulls out some unknown English socialist and holds him up as the model and never mentions Calvin. We'll talk about that. And Carson talks about that, too. For those of you who are interested in the question of America as a Christian nation, I suggest you take a look at John Fee, America Founded as a Christian Nation, a Historical Introduction. This is a good look at Christian thinking in the founding of the Republic, far more complex than often understood. There's just a lot of myths here that we have to work through. And I do think, just to let you know, we are going to have an entire lecture or two devoted to Israel's place in redemptive history, so that we don't make the mistake of looking to Israel's theocratic situation, its unique situation in redemptive history, as a model for modern government. So it's good to look at some of these founding father texts, because they're going to interact with the question of, can we go to Israel and pull out passages in Israel and apply them and argue that those are the ways we try to govern ourselves today? Calvin emphatically said, no, we can't. We'll talk about that. Greg Foster's book, The Contested Public Square, The Crisis of Christianity and Politics, is a plea for a constructive approach. Very thoughtful book in terms of how the attitude, the temperament, and so on. Frazier's book, Religious Beliefs of American Founders, very interesting. Again, it's expensive, but it's a careful look at the complexity of the question as to whether or not America was founded as a Christian nation. So I give you a couple of texts for that. I know that's of interest to several of you. Richard Gamble's book, City on a Hill, is well worth reading. Gamble takes apart the City on a Hill sermon from Winthrop coming across to America, and how it's become a political metaphor and thoroughly secularized in modern American politics. Winthrop was preaching on the church's witness in the New World, and that City on a Hill now has become a metaphor for America as a nation. And Gamble does a good job of just blowing away the idea that that was Winthrop's intention. A very good book, very helpful book. His second book is The War for Righteousness. Gamble deals with the progressive attempt to define America as a messianic nation that will save the world, i.e. Woodrow Wilson. Fascinating to see how before World War I and through the course of World War I, it was the Protestant establishment that thought it was America as the new Messiah among the nations that would be the model for what followed World War I. How did that work out? Anyone interested in the question of separation of church and state, the definitive text is Philip Hamburger. Harvard University Press does a great job on Jefferson's wall of separation in his letter to the Baptist Church, and makes the case that contemporary people who use Jefferson's letter as a way to keep evangelicals and Christians out of the public square thoroughly misunderstand what Jefferson was doing in the historical circumstances. And this from somebody at Harvard Law. Nathan Hatch's book, The Democratization of American Culture, again, along the lines that I suggested with Thoreau and Emerson and James, this is the idea of the sovereign self and how American individualism has had a very corrosive effect upon Protestant Christianity in America. Daryl Hart's book, A Secular Faith, Why Christianity Favors the Separation of Church and State. Daryl is a bit of a provocateur, will overstate things for the sheer joy of overstating things. And I think this is the content is fine. The tenor and tone has offended many, and Daryl probably likes that. I know Daryl. Daryl's a good friend, and I don't say that. If you know Daryl, you know that Daryl has that kind of approach to things. It's a thoughtful book, and those who don't like Two Kingdoms read it, because I think some of his arguments are very, very sound. I just think it will offend some because of the tone, and they'll miss the point of Daryl's arguments. The most important book on the list, I think, is James Davison Hunter's To Change the World, The Irony, Tragedy, and Possibility of Christianity in the Late Modern World. This is a groundbreaking work. It's a cup of cold water in the face of those who seek to change culture through political involvement. We read this here in the Academy. I really would encourage you to get this. Is a tough book, and it will throw water in your face. You're not going to like the approach if you are an optimist about the church's future in America, changing culture. But it's a realistic book, and it raises a bunch of questions that are well worth considering. Thomas Kidd's God of Liberty, Religious History of the American Revolution. Again, another of those books that deals with the role of Christianity in the founding of the Republic. The classic Abraham Kuyper Lectures on Calvinism. You can get it on Kindle for a buck. The classic statement of what has come to be known as sphere sovereignty and Kuyperianism. This is the stated position of many of the Dutch Reformed churches, although in practice I think the Dutch Reformed churches tend to be neo-Kuyperian. And David Van Drunen has raised a very serious question as to whether or not Kuyper would have a lot of sympathy for neo-Kuyperianism. There's a debate over this. A lot of the problem with Kuyper is the primary sources are not in English. They're in the language of heaven, Dutch. So until all of that's translated, a lot of the folks who argue over Kuyper don't read Dutch, and so we're at a disadvantage here. But this is in English. There were lectures given at Princeton Seminary. The Stone Lectures, I think anybody interested in this topic, this is one of the must-reads. You've got to get to this. It's a very important book. H. Richard Niebuhr's Christ and Culture. This is an influential volume that categorizes the different Christian approaches to interaction with culture. This is another one you have to read, because even though I disagree with it in places, it's helpful in others. And this is how people talk. This is the, you know, Niebuhr's given us the categories that we inherit. I want to rewrite them. Carson wants to rewrite them. Others want to rewrite them. But this is the language. And this is where the transformationalism, I think, creeps into the reform bloodstream in America. You read Niebuhr's book, oh, Christ the Transformer of Culture. Oh, yeah, sovereignty of God. God can transform. You know, that it just is kind of a natural thing. A book I would recommend, I think this is very expensive, new, but you can find used ones all over because it's a text. It's called From Irenaeus to Grotius, a Source Book in Christian Political Thought, from the husband and wife team, Oliver O'Donovan and Joan Lockwood O'Donovan. Luther's in here, Calvin's Institutes is in here. The epistle I read earlier is everything you're ever going to need about Christian political theory is here up to the time of Hugo Grotius. So if you like primary sources, as you should, this is the text to get. They're all here. They're concise. You don't have to read unnecessary stuff. Two books, I think you all should read and own if this is of interest to you. David Van Drunen's Excellent Living in God's Two Kingdoms. This is far and away the best contemporary statement of Reformed Two Kingdom thinking. It's an accessible book. I know a lot of URCs have gone through it. I know a lot of Presbyterian churches have used this for adult Sunday school. It's a very, very helpful book. Dr. Van Drunen was here when the book was released and gave an Academy lecture on that. I would recommend it to you, but unfortunately we had some sort of issue with the mic that night and the sound quality is awful. But that is a lecture. If you want to make it through our very poor audio file, you can. But buy the book, read it. I have seen this on Kindle, by the way. I think I purchased my copy for $1.99. It's not always that cheap, but it's like $7 or $8 usually. And this is well worth getting, well worth having. The other book from Dr. Van Drunen that, if this topic is of interest to you, again, you have to work through this, Natural Law and the Two Kingdoms. This is the study of two kingdom thought in the history of the Reformed tradition. So when folks today will act like this is a radical new view, I hate to break it to you, but this has been around from the beginning. Read Van Drunen. You may not agree with all of his nuancing with Calvin or Kuyper, but the fact of the matter is the predominant view in the tradition has been the two-kingdom distinction. It comes from Augustine. We'll talk about this next week. From Augustine to Luther to Calvin and on down into the Reformed tradition. And as I argue tonight, I think it's implied by the Reformed confessions in the very fact that the Reformed confessions have articles devoted to the authority of the state and the authority of the church. If you are even thinking in those categories, you're showing that you're reflecting the kind of thinking that was going on at the time of the Reformation and has come down to us today as two kingdoms. If you disagree with it, that's fine. but don't act like it's new and controversial. Well, it may be controversial to us now because of the blogging war that's going on, but it's in Calvin. Read the last part, the last chapter of the Institutes, the last section, because Calvin will argue for a very clear distinction between the two kingdoms. Now, on the transformationalist side, Al Wolter's Creation Regained is the definitive text. Again, this is the book that we, again, you all should read. This is the standard statement of neo-Calvinism, the idea that Christ's lordship transforms all of life, and therefore the church and the kingdom should be about the business of transforming culture because God is redeeming the earth, not just the individual soul. And it is the position I'm kind of have in the background as the position I'm opposing, and you should, for fairness, read it and be familiar with it. And then last, I suggest this one only because it's so influential, and that's John Howard Yoder, not Yoda, Yoder, Politics of Jesus. This is the contemporary statement of the Anabaptist approach to political engagement, which is, at the time of the Reformation, remember the Anabaptists, and Munzer tried to take over. God told them to, right? And God spoke directly to the prophet, John Matthews, and John of Leiden. And they took over the city of Munster. God told John of Leiden that so-and-so had a pretty wife, so she should be his, right? And he liked the set of cutlery in somebody's store. Well, God told him that people should not have private property anymore, so lo and behold, that cutlery was his. You can just see how this went to anarchy immediately. And so it took the local princes 3 years to raise an army to finally wipe them out to the last person in the city of Munster. And this is what scarred Europe so badly. This is kind of the beginning of the European desire toward state churches, because we're never going to have that again. You have the 30 Years' War and other events as well, but this is a very important. So the Anabaptists, after Munster, went from "it's ours" to "it's yours. We're not having anything to do with it. We're going to go off to our own communities. We're going to do our own thing. We see the civil magistrate as tied to power and tied to force and coercion. So pox on all your house. We're going to have our own communities." And this book has been so influential on a number of contemporary political writers that it's worth knowing and worth being familiar with.